morning, everyone. Today is February 22nd, and this is a class on Mashiach. Okay. Come in. Okay. Here we are. Our question for today is, what does the Tanakh say about what the world will be like when Mashiach arrives? What's going to happen? What is our vision of what the world has in store for the Messianic age? And so you have Tanakhs in front of you, but actually most of the texts that we'll be learning is right in front of us. Okay? If we could give one overarching, one defining feature of the world that we believe will change in the Messianic era, it's shalom. There'll be peace. Nation shall not lift sword against nation. They'll beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. That was the one prevailing proof that Ramban gave to the Christians that the Messiah had not arrived, not by the 12th century or the 13th century, not 1,000 years earlier, is that they still maintain formidable armies and they have not beaten their swords into plowshares, it doesn't look like they'll be able to do so any time in the near future at that particular point. So, the end of Vayikra that describes the what the world could be like if God's graces shine upon us is V'nasati Shalom Ba'aretz. See on the right side? V'nasati Shalom Ba'aretz Ushchavtem V'ein Machrid. I'll give peace in the land. You will be able to rest and recline and sleep without a care in the world, without anything to worry about. Vishpati chayara amina aretz. And I will cause the wild animals to cease from the land. V'cherev lo ta'avor ba'artzachem. And the sword shall not ever pass through your land. Okay, this refers to Israel per se, right? Now, there will be two different interpretations of these words up to the left. This source number one that says Sifra Parshas B'chukosai. The two interpretations here, I don't know if either of them are realistic. Tobin, you don't have the sources? No? You don't have them? Don't know if either of them are realistic. But I would tell you that the two sources, as well as some other commentaries to this, will reflect upon two different approaches to the question at hand, what will the world be like when Mashiach arrives? Right? And what is it that we're praying for? We say, oh, if only Mashiach would come. Right? So the prevailing discussion of this source is, what does the Torah mean when it says, I will cause the wild animals to cease from the land? Are these really wild animals, or are they figurative or metaphorical for something? So that second opinion actually does not appear here. It's a question of two, bless you, extremely, scientifically speaking, very remote possibilities for what we think the answer to our question would be. The first opinion is that there will be no longer have any wild animals in the Messianic era. What you want to do if you want to go to the zoo and you want to see some cheetahs and you want to see some leopards, sorry, there won't be any more, because it says Vishpati Chayara. I'll get rid of all the wild animals. Okay? The second opinion says no, those animals will continue to exist. They just won't be wild anymore. All right? The cheetah will still be able to run, but they will not be predators anymore. Now both of those opinions would constitute a profound change in the food chain of the world. Right? You understand? Right? If, If cheetahs and leopards and lions would no longer be predators, the antelopes would take over the whole countryside.
And then the lopes would run wild.
And then, yeah.
Because the antelopes would be gone. So
100%. And then from there, who knows what the antelopes usually, you can destroy an entire ecosystem by just removing the salamanders.
Mm.
Right? Because what eats them is going to die out. Right? What ate the salamanders, usually preyed upon, are going to proliferate and maybe destroy something. Right? So to say that I gave out something. Didn't make enough comments. Okay. So these are the two opinions about the wild animals. However, there is a totally different approach to all of this, taken by Ibn Ezra, Radak. It's taken by the Pshat commentaries, that all of this is figurative. When Yeshayahu says, for instance, let's read a few different sources on this. Look at source number 4. Okay. Source number 4, verse 20. Okay. He says, Hosea, the prophet, says, V'chorati lohem brit bayomahu im chayat ha-sodeh v'im of ha-shamayim v'remes ha-adama. I will forge a pact with all the animals, the wild animals, and all the creepy crawlers, and the keshet, the bow, the cherev, the sword, u'milchama, the war, eshbor min ha'aretz v'shkaftim levetach. I will cause all those things to cease from the land, and you will reside in assuredness. Okay? Now, to have such a stark juxtaposition between the prophet saying, I'm going to take care of all your problems with those wild animals, and you will never see war, you will never see the sword, you'll never see the bow. It seems to mean that those wild animals are actually nothing but wild nations. Right? Otherwise, what? That juxtaposition doesn't make sense. Right? You agree? The juxtaposition doesn't work. You know, I'll get rid of all those wild animals and war. Really? Israel was in danger from wild animals? Okay, now, this may call up to your mind a pasuk that appears in Parshas Ekev, where Hashem says, Ma'at, ma'at agar shem mipanecha. Slowly, slowly, I'll have you be rid of the Canaanite and Amorite presence. Pentirbe alechem chayat hasadeh. Because if this is done too quickly, there will be a proliferation of the animals will come in. Uh-huh. And you remember all the kids used to leave Camp Morashah very quickly, all in 2 hours. The whole place was teeming with 1,000 kids, and all of a sudden, in 2 hours, everyone's gone. And then you could see the animals sensing that it's quiet, and they all converge on the grounds. The deer, the porcupines, the raccoons, the skunks. The deer got very chutzpahdik. They come anyway. So the animals like to come into the vacuum created when people are not around. And in fact, there's another story like this in Sefer Melachim. When the Assyrians very quickly rid the north of Israel of the 10 tribes, right, what does the Tanakh say? That lions came to and started to terrorize the people that were brought in to live there. Right? That's why the Talmud refers to those people as Gerei Arayot, with an aleph, not a nayin. Gerei Arayot, the converts, because they converted to Judaism, they thought that the God of these Jews who were taken out of Israel got angry with them and sent the lions to punish them for taking over the land of the Israelites. So they converted. They got in some Kohanim and learned how to become Jewish. And then they were called the lion converts. Right? Because they thought that the presence of those wild animals was a sign that they were in bad stead with the God of Israel. So if you look at source number two. So last time we discussed the nature of the character of Moshiach. So they were discussing the nature of the world. So let's do this quickly. It says, look at the English part, chapter 11. Here, you can have it right here. Okay. It says, the wolf shall dwell with the lamb, the leopard lie down with the kid, the calf, the beast of prey, and the fatling together, with the little boy to herd them, the cow and the bear shall graze, their young shall lie down together, the lion like the ox shall eat straw, a babe shall play over a viper's hole, and an infant pass his hand over an adder's den. Right? Okay. So all these things are, if you care to appeal to the source one at the top of the page, is literal. Which means that in the Messianic age, nature will change. Okay, there are those commentaries are of that opinion. Ramban is of that opinion. The Ravid was of that opinion. What does it mean that a child will play with snakes?
Snakes won't be poisonous.
Right? Snakes won't be poisonous anymore. But it goes beyond that. The Ramban used that single line to determine, together with other verses, no doubt, to determine a profound philosophy of how to answer our question. He said, it's very simple. The Messianic age has a precedence in the Bible. It's the Garden of Eden. That's how we started. We ruined it because of a snake, and we're going to get back there. Because whatever the snake represents, the snake, even with according to this approach, the snake represents the forked tongue in our mind that is so good at convincing us to do what even in another side of our mind we know we shouldn't be doing, but it's very good at doing that. Right? It's called the Yetzer Hara. So it's called the Malach HaMavis. It's called the Satan. Call it whatever you want. Different religions call it different things. But it's something within our own minds, right, that starts to justify, it starts to make excuses, it starts to... And we know I shouldn't eat this, I shouldn't do this, I shouldn't touch this, I shouldn't do... But the heart is you know, like Woody Allen said, right? I'm using him because he knows very well how to give in to his evil inclination. So the Gan Eden is a time where we will have go back to that primordial situation where the if you will the snake will be child's play. You get it? The child will play with snakes because a function of leaving the Garden of Eden is that we despise the snake more than anything else, right? I will cause enmity between the snake's descendants and your descendants, did God say to Eve, right? Mm-hmm. So now, getting back and playing with the snake, a picture of a child playing on and of all the snakes mentioned in the Tanakh, the one that Yishael mentions here is the most poisonous of all of them. So the idea of a child playing with this cobra and just, oh, how nice, petting it, means that we're getting back, but I would like to have. I'll take a moment. I would like to have my own take on this, in light of a Gemara in Maseches Brachos that says that we're supposed to love God with all our hearts, right? How do you say hearts in the Torah? B'chol levavcha, b'chol levavchem, right? Mazeh. The Hebrew word for heart is a lev, not a levav. B'chol libchem. B'chol libcha. Mazeh levav. Okay? So in typical Talmudic fashion, there are about 15, 20 such drushes, that when the Torah adds another letter, litzror instead of latzor, you know, things like that, there's something extra going on, because we all have two hearts. One is Yetzer HaTov, one is Yetzer HaRa. So what does the Gemara come to say? An amazing Chiddush. Don't say you don't have Yetzer HaRa. There's no such thing. Everybody has Yetzer HaRa. Serve Hashem with it. Right? If the Gemara says if you didn't have a Yetzer HaRa, you wouldn't get married, you wouldn't build a house, we need a Yetzer HaRa for things. And turn the Yetzer HaRa to do good things. Right? The Gemara once said that the rabbis prayed. It was a time where the Yetzer HaRa for idolatry was very strong. We defeated it. Right? We defeated it even in the eyes of most people. To worship a stick, to worship a sea god, a cloud god, to worship Baal, we've done a good job with that. So then the Gemara says, then they took their sights on destroying the Yetzer HaRa for arayos, for sexual licentiousness. Because the two used to be combined, you know. Avodah Zarah in the ancient world was Yodim Hayu Yisrael Shein Mamish B'Avodah Zarah, Ela Lahatirim Gilui Arayos B'Far Hesya. The ancient idolatry would make 42nd Street in the 70s blush. Mm-hmm. It was all public, it was all part of a religious order, which is really crazy.
Right?
Yeah, as Rashi points out in a few places in the Torah. This is what they were used to. This is what, could be a strategy to get the young people into the temples. Could be. And it wasn't just for your eyes, it was for your participation. So the Gemara says that the Jews prayed for the Yetzer HaRa for this to end. And then no one could find an egg. No one, right? Hi. And so what happened is that the Gemara says that they had to go back on that one. Right? The Yetzer HaRa for Arayos is something that's actually necessary. Right? It's just that the Torah wants us to curtail it, not with these particular people, not at this particular time, not in this particular place, but curtail it. Be in charge. Don't just give in to your inclination wherever you are, whatever you are. I have to have this now, and I want to, right? This is actually the focus of religious observance in general, whatever it might be. I don't just eat what I want when I want it. I can't. I'm fleshix. And you know what? A three-year-old can get this. As long as they don't see hypocrisy. If the child wants ice cream and you say you can't, you just had a hamburger an hour ago, but then the child 2 days later sees the parent eating ice cream right after a hamburger, that's forget it. You've lost him forever, probably. Right? So don't let them see hypocrisy. But if you believe in something and it becomes a milchiks and fleishiks is small potatoes compared to bigger things, right? So when the kid gets sent home from school for cheating on a test, and then before he gets his dressing down from his father, he goes to the bathroom and he sees the towels from the hotel where they just were. So that's not going to do too well, all right? So that's just the get back to our main focus here is that the snake represents the Yetzer HaRa that's going to be conquered before we get it back into Gan Eden. The snake got us kicked out of Gan Eden, and the snake is going to be there at the gate as we come back into Gan Eden. And my take on it is that it's going to be child's play, because we will understand this Gemara. It's an unusual kind of thing. I understand. I know how to serve God with my good inclination. But I'm supposed to even serve God with my evil inclination, because I can't destroy it, right? What we hope is that we get so used to doing the right thing that it either becomes natural to us to continue doing so, or in the very least, if I don't act impetuously and I give some thought, my first inclination is to not do this thing. And hopefully I have some time to realize that I really should be doing this thing, or vice versa, depending on whether the thing should be done or not. But I'll give two different examples of this. One is Nadav and Avihu, who had plenty of time to ask a question over whether what they were doing was right or wrong. Right? And the Haftorah, when we read about their death, which is the story of Uzzah, who had no time at all to ask of whether what he was doing was right or wrong. And he saw the Aron slipping, and he just had to push it back up. So the two stories might be similar in the fact that someone died for drawing too little too close to God, but they're very different circumstances. Right? If you find a wallet and you're looking at it, and the test of whether to return it may be made harsher if you have someone at home who needs medicine and you can't afford it, and there's $400 in here, and it's just about what I need to get this medicine. So, you know, the morality of whether or not you should return this thing may be a greater test for you, right? But you know, depending on your need of the thing. A billionaire who finds a wallet with $400 is no, you know, okay, big deal. Get one of your secretaries to find its owner, right? But someone who has hungry kids at home, you know, it's a bigger question, isn't it? Well, not so fast. You know, it always irks me. An example, I mean, many such examples, but let me give you one quick one, is that in the movie David and Bathsheba, the movie once, and this is back in the 50s, where you still, you know, were loyal to King David, they make a big deal of the fact that Bathsheba's marriage to Uriah was abusive. He was abusive of her. Right? It was a terrible marriage. Right? Why doesn't the Tanakh tell us whether it was terrible or not? Because it doesn't matter. I'm sorry. You know, whatever was done, however you want to understand the various Gemara positions of what was going on in the background there, it doesn't matter. In fact, the Bible's position is, it would appear, that it was actually a very good marriage. How do you know that? Because in the parable, it says that the man loved his lone sheep very much and cuddled it. And you know what I'm talking about, right? David is given a parable about a rich man and the poor man. Right, everyone know? Okay, the evidence from the story itself seems to point that he, you know, to me it's abusive when you're away at war for 6 months and the king tells you to go home and you don't go home. Well, take advantage of going home, right? You have an excuse. Your king told you to go home. That's a good enough excuse. That's not Yetzirah, right? Why wouldn't he go home? It's a different mindset. It's a very different mindset, isn't it? I'm just trying. I'm elaborating here because the discussion of what the world will be like in the Messianic age is so tied in our philosophical mode of this thinking is tied into the conquering, the conquest of the Yetzer Hara. To what extent are will we be responsible of in this battle? And every generation has its different challenges. The internet has its challenges. I assure you, when Morse invented his code, people were saying, "Oh, this is the end. People are not going to have to talk to each other. They're going to just click dots and they're going to communicate with dots and dashes. What a world!" Whoa. And then when the phone was introduced, people said, "What is this crazy? This nuance? What?" They said this when the printing press was invented, right? Which revolutionized communication more than anything before and since.
Socrates, when people were writing down philosophical tracts and putting them on the shelf, he said, "Oh, it's the oral tradition is dead. They'll never know it. They just put it on the shelf."
Right. They knew the Mishnah much better when it wasn't written down than we know it now. Anyway, every generation has its challenges, no doubt. And this snake that Yeshayahu says that the child is going to play with is the getting back into Gan Eden. There's an amazing story. If you turn the page, you'll see all the Mephoshim that say this. I just gave you a Radak in Ibn Ezra. It's this big Radak here on the second page, source number 6 is Ibn Ezra. And they just say, Derech Mashol. Right? They just said this whole thing is a Derech Mashol. It's just a parable. Mehash Shalom. As I started saying, that the overarching message is peace.
There's also the wild animal referred to, "Bapetach atat roves v'alecha tishukateha v'atat timshol bo." At the gate to your house, at your entrance into action, the beast lies crouching to rip out your throat, but you can rule over it.
How do you know it's a beast? It says chatas.
Chat.
If you want to, because roves could be, yes. Yeah.
And its desire is you, but you shall rule over it because you can.
Mm-hmm.
So that's that. You can use Yetzer Hara for Tov.
What's interesting is that Bilam, in his speech, he speaks about Kara Shochav Ka'ari, right? It's like it describes like a lion that's crouching, that's about to pounce. And so that might be where, you know, if you want to compare to this kind of Lashon, Rashi takes it in a whole different direction. Rashi says that's how you wake up in the morning, you know, crouching and getting ready to pounce on your mitzvahs, right? Within an hour of waking up, we've done 25, 30 mitzvahs.
So
take it over.
What does chatat come into it?
No, so, but Kayin is the opposite. You know, Kayin is it's the opposite image.
No, chatat, chet. How does Rashi deal with that word?
No, I think that... I'm making that connection. But no, Hashem is telling Kayin, I know that some type of terrible sin... Crouching means that you're preparing to jump. I know the sin you're preparing to do. I'm in your head. I know you want to kill your brother. Right? It's a theological question. Why didn't God do a better job of convincing him not to kill his brother? Right? Like say something like, give him 2 or 3 seconds of incredibly intense pain and saying you will spend 100 years in this pain if you touch your brother. And then, right after that, give him an incredible moment of extreme euphoric joy, and say, "That's waiting for you if you make peace with your brother." Right? Why didn't God do that? Because that's not how the Yetzer Hara works. That's not how, then. God can do that now for us, right? He can create in this very room an amazing. Experience that will all go out and be messengers of goodness and kindness, and that has to come out from us. So Hashem does give Kain somewhat of a pep talk. Why does he go immediately right afterwards and just without ignoring the whole thing and kill his brother? So you've heard me say so many times, he didn't. He went out to try to learn from his brother what to do, and the pasuk doesn't say anything as a sign that Hevel wasn't interested in helping him. I like where I am right now. You taught me the competitive spirit by not inviting me to serve God together with you in the first place. You wanted him to yourself when you brought your fruit that first day. Right? So now I'm happy having him to myself. Right? So imagine how different the world could be if Cain had asked Hevel for, you know, let's do this together, and Hevel would look at his fruit and say, no, don't bring that. That's not good enough. Look what I'm bringing. You bring better than that. And they would do, oh, look, the whole world would be a different place. All right, so that is the, that's that issue. And then if you turn to the next page, source 8, 9, and 10, that this discussion of whether to take things literally or not amazingly extends to the Talmud. I will allow the Bible to speak in metaphors like this, right? I'll allow. I mean, the Radak, you know, the Mefarshim, the Metzudos, they take it figuratively. It's not a real animal. It's not the real animals that will cease from the land. Although, if you recall, about 15 minutes ago when we talked about the conquest of Canaan slowly so the animals don't take over. And that could be the simple pshat of what Hashem is saying there. I won't let the wild animals take over the land, having nothing to do with the Messianic era, actually, but having to do with a slow conquest of the land whereby the animals will not fill in any vacuum. Right? That's what Vishpati Chai Romanoitz. Source number 9, which is translated right underneath, it's a very old translation from the Ein Yaakov, which is that in the future, right, the land of Israel is destined to yield ready-made cakes and ready-made cloaks. Wow, really? Now, I think this is a secret. There's a sod. There's a secret going on here. Again with animals. Because we humans, by our lights, we can say, I'd rather be a human than a giraffe, than an antelope. Right? We live longer, but a human is the longest living mammal on planet Earth. So we have an ability to actually profoundly elongate our lifespans. They apparently, at the time of Gan Eden and somewhat after, was somewhat longer. Until we ruined it with extreme sinning. But be that as it may. I tell you, the Gemara that's not in these sources, the Gemara at the end of Maseches Kedushin, where a rabbi is looking out at the vast meadow and a beautiful field, and he sees animals running around, and he starts addressing each one of them about what they do and how they do it. And he said, I never saw any of you out there not living your lives just the way you're supposed to. You eat what you're supposed to. Right. Yeah, there could be a mess up here and there where you have an accident, you make a mistake, someone. But they largely do what they're supposed to do. They're not to be judged on any of that. They don't have the knowledge to for that. But me, the human, for whom you were all created, right? I mess up all the time. Hardly a day goes by where we humans do something we shouldn't be doing. Eating something I know I shouldn't be eating, right? Touching someone I shouldn't be touching, or whatever it is, or doing things I shouldn't be doing each and every day. What is that? Me, the one who's the king over all these other kingdoms, and you're all there created for me, and I mess up. Only I have emotional problems. Only I have economic problems. Only what they don't have. What problem? I have to worry. Where am I going to live? Where's my child going to live? Where am I going to pay for the wedding? Where am I going to pay for the clothing? The answer is that every other animal, every other living thing that moves in this world, they don't have to work for their everything is prepared for them, right? They don't process food, they don't make cake. Whatever ingredients we put into a cake, they find in the field and they eat.
But they have to hunt for it.
Nachinami, and it's there. It's so readily, abundantly there for them. We mess that up for them too. By taking their natural resources,
right.
and sometimes we leave things for the birds that they shouldn't be eating, mm-hmm. or for the cats and the dogs that they shouldn't be eating. Right? I just saw a sign, something right around here. It said human grade dog food. No, dogs are not supposed to be eating what humans eat. It's not good for them.
Maybe it's humans they're feeding to the dogs.
I thought of that when I first read it, but I don't think so.
I had somebody call out to somebody else who was walking his dog, hey, Alpo.
Okay.
Can I ask you a question?
Well, I think Camilla just had her hand up first. What was
I just wanted to say I had a dog, and my dog lived to 16 years and a half. I never fed him dog food. He always ate from my plate, and he also ate chocolate and ice cream.
Chocolate.
They say dogs
should eat. Yeah, they say that, but I don't know.
You got used to it?
I guess he never had the issue to work. A small dog, like a chihuahua.
Okay.
I think that's a lot of nonsense in the culture also, so they can sell dog food and then dogs get cancer.
It could be.
Because they don't put the right ingredients.
That could be also. That could be it. And the people who make dog food have only one thing in mind, to make money. They're not doing it for the good of dogs. Okay.
You know, with the Nachash, it said that the punishment was that the dust will be readily available. They'll never have to ask for anything. But for all animals, it's really pretty readily available. You just kill another animal.
It's just that dust is the most available thing.
So that's the whole thing.
So, yeah. But as far as the animals, they don't have to process anything for clothing, for shelter, for food. Everything they have is what they have. You know, they don't have to make leather for shoes. They don't have to weave any garments for clothes. They don't have to process anything for food. I hope you see what's emerging from this. The 39 melachos of Shabbos. Right? The first 11 is for baking and cooking. Then the next eight is for weaving materials and for clothing. Then the next seven is for shoes and leather works, right? And then, well, I skipped a few in between, but there's about another 10, 11, 12, 13 for building, you know, writing, building things, writing plans, things that have to do with building. So processing food, processing clothing and leather works for shoes and building for residents is what makes us different than animals, which is why we can actually say that Shabbos is a Zecher Letzias Mitzrayim. How could Shabbos be Zecher Letzias Mitzrayim? Shabbos was mentioned in Bereishis. Shabbos is a Zecher L'Maaseh Bereishis, not Zecher Letzias Mitzrayim. No, because in Egypt we were turned into animals. Right? We were turned into beasts of burden. So to remember Yetzias Mitzrayim is a good thing to do. To remember Yetzias Mitzrayim is to keep Shabbos. Not only to keep Pesach, but to keep Shabbos. Because Shabbos, the 39 malachot of the construction of the Mishkan, right? How do we know that the Shabbos is connected to the Mishkan? Because every time the Torah tells us to build a Mishkan, in the middle of the story it says, but make sure you keep Shabbos. Okay, so the very essence of the creativity that we're supposed to stop doing, refrain from in observance of Shabbos, is what went into the Mishkan, which reminds us in these four categories of the difference between the human and the animal. And as soon as we can foster a mindset that understands this difference and incorporate it into a worldview, then we're on our way to the Messianic era, where the clothing can be found on the tree, and the ready-made roll will be found on growing from a stalk. Now, again, do you take that literally? The answer is that the one who takes it literally, that the lion will actually literally lie down with the lamb,
and they'll
eat straw. The bear will lie with the calf, and so those who take that literally understand this literally as well. I once remember when I was teaching this once in the DAF, I said, you know, I tell my kids all the time, you think money grows on trees? Mm. Right? So when they say that clothing will grow on trees, means that with the peace dividend of the Messianic era will allow us to use our resources to make these things come more readily. No one will want for clothing or any of these other things. And actually, it continues to say wheat will grow to be 30 feet high, and fruit will be so large and will be so plentiful, and one apple will serve a whole school, you know, with chop off pieces and you know, so all right, it could be that with if you just read this English translation under source number 9, you'll see numerous such examples. The abundance of the grain, etc., etc. And that's not that you can take literally, or you can take it figuratively, or you can understand it as some kind of peace dividend that will lead to all these things coming very easily for us, like it'll be growing on trees, quotes, right?
But Rabbi, is any of this good? Don't we say Tov Torah Derech Eretz and idle hands and every culture of evil, whatever, and that we have to balance the struggle with the what are we going to do? Have learned Shvel Adbams?
Well, clearly we'll be working on these things. It'll just allow us to have more free time to find cures for cancer and things like that. But you know, there will always be something to work. And the proof is, in the Garden of Eden, no one should make the mistake of thinking that we're just sipping lemonade in the lounge chair. That God put us there la'avda u'lashamra, right? What was that? What's the avoda? And I don't think that's limited to gardening work. La'avda u'lashamra was all kinds of you know. They were only in the garden for 1 hour, the Gemara says, so I don't know how much it ended up being, but we were not put in the garden for a week's vacation in the Bahamas. You know, the garden was meant to be something where we could work on our humanity and guard it. La'avda, not just la'avda, but la'avda ul-shamra, right? Be a shomer. That's a key you know, a key point. That's to be a Shomer Shabbos is a guardian. You're a guardian of Shabbos, which you can only be, of course, if you know the laws of Shabbos. You know, but this is a crucial point.
But to work on it means you still need the Yetzirah from the get-go, right?
In Hanami, but you know, control it.
So we're created with the Yetzirah. It's not that upon eating of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil.
Right, that is a profound dispute between Christians and Jews about what that is.
But what?
Right?
What?
Because Christians believe that before eating from that tree, there was no Yetzirah. There was no. Like the tree we're put in the Yetzirah, that Jesus now has to help us.
Yeah,
without his help, we're lost, we're fallen. So that's considered.
Do you think this is the sign? I saw this nature thing about people who save whales who are caught up with fishing nets, or they've been tied down somehow because they're caught in something. And these scientists, they're marine biologists or whatever. They go around to the different seas and they cut whales free that have been entrapped. And then one day, this woman who's a scientist, she went into the water near a gigantic blue whale. She wasn't afraid of it. It was huge. It was came right up to the boat. And she was looking at it. It was looking at her. And all of a sudden, it sort of pushed her back towards the boat. And when she turned around, she saw a shark was coming from the other side of the whale, and the whale was actually protecting her from the shark.
Mm-hmm.
And we hear stories like that about dolphins, but never about blue whales.
Mm-hmm.
Well, is that like a sign of Mashiach?
You know, there's another Gemara. These are all Gemaras found scattered throughout Shas. There's a Gemara that says that when Mashiach comes, people will be very chutzpahdik beforehand, and they'll have pnei kelev. Pnei kelev, because a dog is considered a very chutzpahdik animal. It does chutzpahdik things.
It's loyal, though. It's loyal.
Yeah, but it has a, you know. Anyway, so chutzpah is I do what I'm doing. I don't care what you think. You know. So it says Pnei Kelev. So I remember some years ago, it was about 30 years ago, Eisha Torah found in California, there was a dog and master looking contest. In other words, a master that looks like his dog. And the guy that won was a crazy, mamish looked like his dog.
Oh, God.
He probably made himself look like the dog, but he had the same hair, the same features. It was crazy. So they said, oh, this is a sign that Mashiach is coming, because people are so crazy, they're making these stupid contests. This must be the sign of Mashiach. I think that in itself is crazy. But yeah, okay, you know, in animals, we're clearly evolving. I don't know if animals are any smarter now than they used to be. I don't know if people are smarter now than they used to be. But I've been curtailing much of our presentation today to this theme that that is consistent with when the Gemara in Ksuvah says that when Mashiach comes, we will find ready-made food and clothing and shoes and ready-made things that we use and need that we normally have to process. When we find them on trees, that this too has numerous ways to be understood. Look, we have conveniences that 200 years ago, kings would have considered to be forget about that. That every public school kid has a phone in fifth grade that has more power on it than the most powerful computer did in the 1960s.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing. Air travel has been, it's so cheap now, relatively speaking. If you're old enough to remember what it would cost to take a plane from here to Los Angeles in the 60s, you'd have to save up for 2 years in order for such a thing. And now you get on the sale, you get $99, $129. But I'm just saying that we have evolved significantly in so many ways of conveniences and running water and refrigeration and microwaves. I mean, we press a few buttons and dinner is ready in 5 minutes. And the question is that Our experience shows us, from the Greeks to the Germans, to so many examples in between, that when we have these advances, it sometimes comes at the expense of morality and wisdom. All right, so I'm sure Camelia has a wise remark on this.
Yeah, I just wanted to say what we were saying before with the lion laying down next to the lamb and then the snake not being poisonous, the child playing. I was thinking that perhaps in the future we will become so technologically advanced that we'll be able to modify behavior. Because there are, certain DNA features that are responsible, for their interaction, they might be causing wild behavior, so we might be able to get to that point.
I remember seeing in the futuristic film called The Giver, they have such a thing where everyone's behavior is modified. At first, voluntarily, and then they're sort of, then it just becomes natural that they're doing. They have to take some kind of shot every day, and it modifies their behavior. And then someone somehow learns what wants to feel. What happens if he stops taking the shot? And all of a sudden, he gets to realize what's going on with the world, and he rebels. But I would hope that since our message of God's appearance to Cain, as it was, with all its lacking, is that's not a good thing, right? We have to be the one in charge of which bet we let rule over the other bet in the word levavcha, right? Getting an unfair advantage is not something we were meant to have, right? Now again, it's up to us look, we're living in a relatively calm time, in a different continent. And 70, 80 years ago, we would have bigger fish to fry, like survival, than how cold it is outside. I mean, it's hard to fortify the neshama to move in an upward position towards a messianic era when you're busy worrying about whether your trip to the grocery is going to get you food or get beaten up on the way because you're Jewish or something like that. So we have to take advantage of all our conveniences and work accordingly. So all of this is codified on source number 11 in the Rambam that says that no one should think that the world will change in any way when Mashiach comes. Right. Our rabbi said, "Ein bein ha'olam hazeh l'imos ha'mashiach ha'lashivut malchus bavad." The only difference between this world and as it is now in the Messianic era is only in with respect to that's halacha bet amru chachamim. That's not really fair because it's not chachamim; it's a dispute in the Talmud. Just because you side with this one, all of a sudden becomes the chachamim.
No, it isn't. Amru chachamim. There were among those who said you could play with that.
But he's 40. They call their sages chachamim.
And he means chachamim, the opinion of the rabbis in the Talmud. It's not. It's a dispute. All right. Okay. It could be. Some smart rabbis like you're saying. But this was disputed. Not everyone held this way. Some in the Talmud held that the world will have noticeable, appreciable changes in the Messianic era. Right. And if you look further, if you turn to the page further, you see that this dispute also manifests itself in the discussion of the messianic individual. Right? You know what? I think that's supposed to be. Yeah, it's in the. Let's turn to the very last page. Let's just get to the last page. Okay, just read the Rambam towards the right. It says, "Va'al yale al datcha shehamelech haMashiach tzirich lasos osos umofsim mechadesh dvarim ba'olam umechayemesim mechayotzi b'dvarim elu ein hadavar kach." Don't think that when Mashiach presents himself, that he's going to be put to some kind of test of performing miracles and reviving the dead. He's talking about a Jesus test. He's saying that's how the Christians thought that they have to find someone who's performing miracles for them, and then that that cemented his chazaka of being the Mashiach, right? Be careful with that. Someone can have sleight of hand, right? Moshe was not believed because of his staff. He was believed because he had a meaningful, worthwhile message. Right? He says, Sharei Rabbi Akiva, Chacham Gadol Mechachmei Mishnayo, Hu Haya Nusei Kelev Shel Ben Kuzi Ba Melech, Vo Yo Omer Alav Shu HaMelech HaMashiach. Right? Rabbi Akiva believed that Ben Kuzi Ba, we call him Bar Kochba, was Mashiach.
Hmm.
The Rambam seems to exaggerate a little bit about what the original sources say about their relationship, but I think it does fit in to the fact you've heard that it was Dafka Rabbi Kiva's students who died in this Magefa, you know, during the Sphere of Sa'omer, like 24,000 or 48,000 of them, because they didn't have a good respect. I have to tell you, there have been some Rabbanim over the years who have shried Chavakayim. This is a slander of Rabbi Akiva. I don't accept it. I've been saying this for 30 years here. What it means when it says that Rabbi Akiva's students died between Pesach and Shavuos, they died in battle. And it was a censored text, and now they just made a scientific edition of a Medrash that describes this battle, and it says the students died in Milchemes Beitar. That when the Bar Kokhba revolts, for the last about 3 years, that in the final revolt that was put down by Hadrian, Rabbi Kiva's students didn't have kavod because they weren't soldiers. They weren't good soldiers. They didn't. What area of human experience needs the most kavod of all is battle. Sir, yes, sir. Any deviation, and they're going to make you make 400 push-ups, right? Because you have to listen. Don't question. You sure you want to take that hill? You'll shoot the guy for asking that. You need kavod in battle.
Mm.
Right? You need kavod. You look at the drill sergeants, and you'll know what kavod is, right? Right. So the boys were left from the base of Medrash because Rabbi Akiva thought that if he thought Bar Kokhba was Mashiach, of course he sent his students to fight with him, and that's where they died because they weren't good soldiers. So why did they write it that way? Because it was censored. It was censored by our censors. We didn't want later sources to know that the base of Medrash gets emptied to rebel and make revolution.
That's the three promises.
That was somewhat earlier. Yes, that's Vespasian. Give us the base of Medrash, right? But Rabbi Akiva's time with Hadrian, that was not a good, at least according to the Rambam or this Mahalach I'm taking now, was not a worthwhile. You could maybe make a deal with this group, but this was like making a deal with someone that no deal was possible. So you just had to go out and fight. Because they're going to enter the base Medrash and kill everyone there, you might as well go out and take an arm and fight. But the later generations didn't want people to think that's what we're doing.
Who were they fighting?
This was the Hadrianic repressions and persecutions. They outlawed practice of Judaism. They under pain of death to give smicha,
I'm not following. So why was it everybody thinks there was a plague and that they were destroyed because of lack of respect?
Well, so that it was more convenient when you're writing this down 300 years later, it was convenient on our side to report that these students died in mass in the plague. We don't want the censor, the Christian or Roman or whatever, to know that the Jews are a rebellious lot that fights
the establishment.
Is that the real reason?
I'm suggesting this here. I mean, we've been all around the world this morning, with so many different topics, but the Rambam's proof that Moshiach is just a regular person is the fact that Bar Kokhba was followed by Rabbi Akiva. No one asked Bar Kokhba to do any miracles. So the Ravid comes in and says, what are you talking about? They did ask him to do a miracle. See the Ravid source number 3? Amar Avraham, V'halo ben kuzi bahaya omer, ana hu malko de mashicha. He announced himself. He said, I am Mashiach. V'sholcho chachamim lebodko. The rabbis did test him. Imorach v'dayin ilav. V'kivan delo avid hachi katluhu. And they tested him. What was the test? The test is source number 1. See, Mashiach tichsiv, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the Gemara says, "V'nasata lav ruach Hashem ruach chachma vina etc. ruach etzel gvura ruach das v'yos Hashem." Uksiv harecho b'yiras Hashem. He will be inspirited with the Spirit of God. What does that mean? So the Gemara darshins it to refer to sense of smell, which I've been struggling with of late, that you'll be able to smell justice. Huh? So Bravanel on his parish says that the sense of smell is harder to fool than the sense of sight and sound. Right? So you can have an optical illusion, and you can think you're hearing something when it's something else. Now we have artificial scent. He didn't know about that. But at that time, when you're smelling a banana, you know you're not smelling a thick steak. You know, you're smelling rusted, you're not smelling cumin. All right? So it means that Mashiach will call justice out and know what true justice is, because everyone has a different idea of justice, right? And when Bar Kokhba wasn't able to do that, but they had it as a real test. He said, here's a judgment case, right? Close your eyes, smell, and tell us what's the verdict. And they gave him that test, and he couldn't do it, so they killed him. So the Ravid, I hope the Ravid understands this somewhat figuratively, that he couldn't do something, you know, extraordinary and that was beyond nature. And so they said, they didn't kill him, but they said, you must not be Mashiach. So the Nosei Kelim, the commentaries to the Rambam, say that the Rambam rejected this source. There are three different opinions of what V'harecho B'yiras Hashem means. It doesn't mean that the Rambam has to accept that one. Right? That they asked him to sniff justice? Think of such a thing. But it's just a metaphor, again, for requiring him to do something beyond normal nature.
So will we evolve in the Messianic age? Will we be different?
Yes, so that's the Rambam's opinion is, it's no different than the world is today. It's just that there will be peace. And a small percentage, a tiny percentage of the world population will make their way to Israel and revive Jewish observance in life in the land of Israel. Now, I submit to you that if you would ask the Rambam 800 years ago, or Rashi 1,000 years ago, and ask them, what do you think will change in the world from what you experience today, right, if you're fortunate enough to be alive when Mashiach comes? Give me 10 things. Right? Go home and think of 10 things. We have 8 or 9 of them. I don't know if they'd write running water or clothing growing off trees.
But about the revival of the dead?
So that's coming after Mashiach.
Oh.
The Rambam says, we're not going to ask Mashiach to revive any dead.
Mm.
That's coming afterwards. But Christianity, you know, put that in, you put them, you know, the miracles
Jesus.
In
there. So does that mean that we will be more peaceful?
Yeah.
How are they
going to
change us?
Only we can change us.
What?
Only we can change us.
Yeah.
It's an old story. They say, how can you make sure your children don't do drugs? Nothing. There's nothing you can do to make sure your children don't do drugs. Yeah. Only they can stop themselves from doing drugs. You can behave in certain ways that will make them make a more wise decision. Mm-hmm. But there is a good reason why the Bible calls children like arrows being shot. Right, the closer you hold it to your heart, the more likely it'll hit its target. But once you let go of that thing, and let go we must, right? Everyone has a knot in their stomach the first time the kid takes out the car by themselves. Right? So once you let go, a fickle wind, a bad friend, a bad book, a bad movie, I don't know, a bad experience, a bad, you know, some hypocrisy, some, right? Just do your best, be true, and right? Okay, that's our presentation for today. Next time is February 26th. Mm. Next time I have a great topic. It's called the apocalyptic prophecies in the Bible, like the end of day prophecies in Daniel, Yechezkel. Of course, I'm going to try to prove from these apocalyptic prophecies that we are now currently living in the Messianic era, which the Talmud says could last hundreds of years. But I do believe that we have begun the Messianic era. Full disclosure, though, lots of other commentaries said this 1,000 years ago.
And especially during the Spanish Inquisition.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay, everybody, have a great day.
Thank you.
Stay warm.